Hello. It's good to talk to you. We've reached a point in this journey of ours, which feels to me like about halfway, because I know there's another term of the subject coming for me, and which may feel to you like the beginning of the end, because you have decided that this is more than enough tedium about this subject for 1 year. And either way, this is the moment at which it is appropriate to sum over the nature of the problem as we have investigated it, and to begin to think about what it would mean to start solving it. So, to sum up what we have seen so far in as condensed a fashion as possible, let us say that after the Second World War, and with a greater transformative pacing in the last quarter of the 20th century, the human race began to build a digital nervous system for itself that would transcend individuals and create connections of a pervasive kind throughout society. The original immediate motive was the creation of decentralized computer networks capable of surviving nuclear war and the attempted decapitation of the military and political governance of the society by an adversary possessed of the power to destroy pretty much everything on the North American continent. That pipe dream that nuclear war could be made survivable by the decentralization of the digital services of command and control gave birth first to the ARPANET and then to the Internet, a set of rules for the operation of computers in decentralized peer-to-peer fashion, which ultimately, combined with free software and inexpensive hardware, made it possible to connect every human being all the time to a network of machinery which could be used to make everything that anybody wanted to learn or understand possible to learn or understand anywhere, regardless of the ability to pay. A great and profound revolutionary change in the nature of human society, offering forms of intellectual and social liberation that were otherwise impossible throughout the millions of years of previous human life. But that's not what we did with it. The process of turning a network that was built for equality, peerage, absence of hierarchy, into a network populated by centralized services operated in a master-servant or superior-to-inferior form of technological architecture, in which human beings and their computers at the endpoints of the network became consumers of services produced and distributed centrally, is the subject of my 2010 talk, Freedom in the Cloud, which I assigned to you. Out of the structures which centralized services, originally born from the architectural preferences of the Microsoft monopoly, which was then the dominant manufacturer of software for small computers in the world, and which used its dominance over APIs at the edge of the net to create centralized server structures owned by customers, but nonetheless designed and architected by Microsoft, was the transitional method by which we departed from the inherent democracy of the original non-hierarchical peerage-oriented structure of the internet towards a centralized system which, in the second decade of the 21st century took the fateful step that led to the creation of a species-wide parasitic relationship with a multi-party digital organism that we have been calling here the parasite with the mind of God. That restructuring of the net, a furtherance of centralization of services in an architectural sense, was juiced, fueled, metabolically enabled by the growth of web services for sharing in ordinary daily life, inexpensive forms of messaging and social sharing and the media delivery from individuals to small groups of family and friends, to the creation of influencing structures in which effectively advertising content was created by individuals for rebates from the companies whose gear they helped to sell. All of those structures were created around a basic deal, which was, we will offer you free services, Mr. Individual, Ms. Person, the family, for operation on devices that you buy at high prices, that you care and feed and look after religiously, which are devices designed to collect your behavior and to spy on you. In return for using these, quote, highly convenient devices linked to these highly convenient services that we provide you, quote, for free, close quote, we will accustom you to registering all your behavior all the time, passively and actively, every waking hour of your life and sometimes during sleep as well, in order to learn everything about you, so that we can build a digital structure which will fill this species-wide network with advertising. Structures designed to influence your behavior based on our pervasive invasion of your privacy, our acquisition of all your behavior, from which all your behavior that we don't get through the spy satellite in your pocket can be inferred, so that we can predict on the basis of what you have been doing for the last 45 minutes in your life what you might want next, so that we can, by being inside the perimeter of your consciousness, sell to other people in digital auctions conducted trillions of times a day the opportunity to meet you where your thoughts are. For this purpose, every form of interconnection in that originally democratic network, messaging of every kind, sharing of what your eye sees and your ear hears, and the search box containing everything you wish for, want, hope to get, fear to have, all of that information can coalesce inside an object whose basic purpose it is to use that behavior to emit stimuli that will cause you to behave further. This, the creation of a digital behaviorist, an object, an entity spanning the entire planet and all the people on it, constantly engaged in testing, notifying, beeping, pushing, facilitating contact between other human beings and you for the purpose of registering your behavior and selling opportunities to affect your behavior by creating more behavior for the same organism to ingest and use. This life cycle, which is not the life cycle of the human being, which is the life cycle of the digital organism, the parasite, with the mind of God, the structure that contains both the most detailed information available about every single human being all the time, and the structure which possesses pattern recognitions, machine learning programs, algorithms, as they are now called by people who never wrote one. These structures of pattern recognition, of deliberate discovery of what data has in it that the makers of the data didn't know, this synoptic view across the entire human race of how humans as a class behave, all the things we cannot see about ourselves that can only be reflected in an entity which has both the completely precise information about how you are breathing, what your heart rate is, how you are walking, what you are thinking about, who is talking to you, what they are talking to you about, and at the same time, in parallel, seeing that across billions of human beings all the time, never forgetting anything. That digital entity, which now possesses a kind of knowledge of the human race we have never previously conceptualized except under the rubric of the mind of God, that entity does not think in terms of mind. It is a behaviorist. It thinks in terms of stimulus and response. It thinks in terms of understanding all human activity on the basis of the statistical relationships between stimuli produced in the environment and by the creature itself, and the responses, the clicks, the swipes, the stops, the starts, the buys, the sells, everything that happens to and by and for human beings inside the structure of those stimuli received. That creature now defines what the texture of human life is like at the lowest level, the several thousand times a day that you interact with the spy object, clicking, swiping, notifying, being notified, pushing, pulling, and the nature of the thought process to which you are conditioned as a consequence of all those interactions, what kind of human being you learn to be, all of this is now becoming primarily the work of the teacher, the parasite. The partner in being human that isn't human, but that is more pervasively attached to your nervous system than any human being can be. We live there now. In the blink of an eye, in a decade, across the entire long history of the human race, from 5 million years ago when we split off from our closest biological cousins, to roughly 200,000 years ago when we learned to master complex articulate speech, to the transition to the written word some many thousand years ago, the human race has defined the nature of its existence and has altered everything about the planet on the basis of our forms and abilities to teach one another. And in the last decade, a microsecond in human life against the scale of our long life as a species, in 10 years, we built a structure and endowed it with a living purpose, made the first profound artificial life form that wasn't merely something to sweep the floor, and we are using it to change what it means to be human by changing the way in which we are taught, primarily from a form of reading and listening and interacting with other human beings to a form in which our primary interlocutor is an entity which does not need or believe in the existence of a concept of mind. In 10 years. By the end of this century, indeed, by the end of the third quarter of this century, every human mind will develop from birth through life to death with a primary interlocutor whose ability it is to stimulate, observe, analyze, and affect further human behavior, all on the basis of the denial of the concept of mind. The human mind itself is the thing being digested by the enzymes excreted by the parasite. And we are so fully enthralled in the tightest possible sense to that relationship that we do not know what is happening to us in it. Our immune responses to the dissolution of our mind over the course of a lifetime, and our immune responses to watching the further dissolution of the concept of mind within our children, our dissociation of the process through which the human race is passing is in itself a function of the parasite's presence. Like, say, the rabies virus, the parasite's physiological relation to us is psychoactive. It produces behavioral change. This is not unknown in the world of life on Earth. It's rather common, in fact, that parasites act to modify host behavior in order to benefit the parasite. The coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, in fact, any infectious disease, modifies behavior in a primary way in order to cause the physiology of spread, the coughing, the sneezing, the particulate matter of infection emerging from the airways of somebody with a respiratory disease, the inhabitation of sexual fluids for the purpose of securing transmission during sexual contact, the forms of digestive parasitism which excrete the reproductive materials of the parasite in the feces of the etc. But here, of course, a different thing is happening, something changing mind which operates not at the level of physical penetration, but at the level of mental reorganization. And it is happening so rapidly that we are not aware that it is occurring. We are aware only of having surrendered anxieties, doubts, and pains to the machine, a feeling which we call convenience. And on the basis of this convenience, the lulling of one set of concerns and its replacement by new behaviors raising other concerns, that the parasite secures its market, which is, well, the reorientation of the functions of our day at the granularity of seconds, at the granularity of minutes, the hours spent with engagement with the materials of the parasite's construction, all of which pulls our thought, our attention, our way of being, in the end, our very conception of ourselves in the direction that is beneficial to the parasite, be it beneficial or harmful to us, depends on what you mean by us. So this is what we have been observing in occurrence over the past weeks. The history of this event, as fraught with meaning as anything that has ever happened to the human race, occurring so swiftly against the background of human cultural evolution, fast as that is compared to natural selection, occurring so rapidly against the background of human cultural evolution that you, the generation to whom it happened, the people who happened to be in existence at the moment when the spy satellite dropped in the pocket and the applications began assembling the parasite over there at the other end, in the data centers you never saw, in the places that you never were, screened by the companies that never told you what it was that they were doing, in that moment where this new, dark, and unlovely form of human life was being framed, you were there. But that's not how it felt. That wasn't how it was supposed to feel. It was supposed to feel natural. And the work that I have been doing, with whatever badness and sloppiness and inadequacy I have brought to it, the work that I have been doing for these past weeks was designed to turn that decade of transformation into something you could see. Of course, seeing a thing doesn't mean wanting to see it. And that which we do not want to see, which passes the nerve barrier between that ball of gel at the front and that ball of goo at the back, that process of seeing is subject to the operation of mind, including that process of the operation of mind that Leon Festinger at the midpoint of the 20th century named the repression of cognitive dissonance. What we see, which is inconsistent with our established vision of the world, will soon be unseen as our mind works on it. And thus the tragic and powerful irony that the parasite's ability to dissolve the human mind, to replace the structures grown up over 200,000 years with the values achieved at the end of that period in the tiny 5,000-year space we call civilization and the tiny 500-year space that we call the discovery of the individual and the creation of the idea of the autonomy of the individual, her rights, her freedoms, the individuality of her salvation, the meaning of her life as construed by herself, aggregating to the government of the people, by the people, for the people, the dissolution of all of that within 10 years, the adoption of a behaviorist technology of social life spanning everybody and embracing everything is only possible because we are in fact creatures of mind, and mind includes the repression of cognitive dissonance, and the parasite can use our ability to unsee, to render its effect on us invisible, taking just long enough that we are not conscious of seeing it as it transforms everything we have previously known into something we have never previously experienced. And in two generations, at the end of this century, there will be no one left alive who remembers what it used to mean to be human. If it weren't for the fact that something similar is happening to the structure of the planet on which we live, if it weren't for the fact that we have simultaneously to confront another example of our ability to destroy everything we have known and to turn it into something we have never experienced by a process just a little too slow to be fully conscious of it and to be immediately affected by the profit motive in the way we handle it, if it weren't for the fact that that were going on at the same time, I would be unable to convince you that it is happening in this crucial area too. Humankind now faces two such problems, existentially important. Its relation to the biosphere of which it is a part, the life of life on the planet, will now be distorted in ways that have not happened for billions of years, in the case of the nitrogen cycle, and for tens of thousands or maybe tens of millions of years in the carbon cycle. The biota of the planet will now be altered by processes we set in motion happening from a geological perspective in less than the blink of the blink of a jiffy of the blink of an eye. And at the same time, we will be doing something similar over a similar time scale to the nature of human thought itself. And because there are two such things, it is possible that you may gain sufficient parallax to see them. That you will not have to have lived a life in the midst of the changes in technology, law, and politics to know what is going on. Because there are two such things, there is a hope that I can teach you. But still, the pressure not to see, the act of mind that represses cognitive dissonance. No, we are not really doing this to ourselves. It is just that we have so much convenience. We don't need to see what Eben says we should see. We can just have convenience instead. That pressure is hydraulically overwhelming. It's the weight of the lake behind the dam. And with the very human mind that we will soon be losing, we resist that weight and try to hold a stable picture of the world together. And though it is not at all clear that in any one individual or even in a group I can have the slightest effect in doing what is, after all, threatening to break the dam, to create the sense of existential urgency, the realization that, yes, something irreversible is happening now, and we cannot reverse it, we can only divert its flow so as to harm ourselves less, that realization may be a generation of human beings tasked to find their reasonable relationship to that unbearable reality twice. With respect to everything outside and with respect to everything inside, perhaps you can do that. Yours is the generation that will get to choose, as Dan Geer says, the last time. Just as yours is the generation that will not be able to reverse the massive alteration of the climate of the earth, but to divert it slightly, away from the worst and towards the better. Not to achieve perfection, whatever that would mean, not to prevent change, whatever that would mean, but only to govern ourselves as we deserve to be governed in light of our responsibility to those who will come after us, those not yet born, those not yet thought of, whose world we cannot understand, and yet whose world we have some responsibility to improve. That we are doing all of this in the midst of a kind of crisis arising even more rapidly and hopefully to be governed by our best angels even more quickly, such that we will have only killed some millions of human beings unnecessarily through our mismanagement of public health, that we are doing it in the midst of such a crisis, which leads me to be standing here in my isolation booth overlooking the river and the park and not seeing you, whom I am trying to affect, that we are doing this now in some perverse way, maybe a hell. Because humanity is being collectively reminded, and you and I, in our strangely distant mode of trying still to teach and learn in human scale between ourselves, linked by voice, if nothing else, maybe in that intensity of the experience of transformation, we can learn to accept, without the nausea accompanying metamorphosis, what is happening otherwise to ourselves. But what would we do if we were trying to divert this flow, if we were trying to break the dam on our understandings while not flooding our entire world and washing it away? As the sea creeps up around us and the great cities of the earth come closer and closer to submergence, and as our ability to maintain the autonomy of our minds, as well also as our liberties in society, the subject of next term's inquisition, as our efforts in those directions are blurred, let us say, and sometimes made invisible altogether to ourselves, as we lose all sight of the alternatives, no sense of what we might have instead, how would we build to change all this, even a little bit, thus preserving for a little while longer our hope of preserving altogether what it has meant these last few hundred years to be a human being in a world of humanism? What we might do to save our values from turning into the goo that the enzymes of the parasite would make of it for the parasite's benefit? Everywhere along the way, I have tried to remind you that we sit on a stool with three legs here in this course. Everything we analyze, everything we propose, everything we evaluate, every form of social action that we see or wish for stands on the basis of the operation of our technology, the nature of our law, its content and its process, and the politics, that is, the distributions of power and the institutions for distributing power in society by which we organize ourselves, by which the few govern the many, and by which the many aspire to equality of rights and power, to the government of the people, by the people, for the people, that we call democracy. Or, alternatively, the forms of autocracy fueled by the parasite, which allow the few to govern the many such that the many do not even wish for equality and democracy and the protection of their rights, because those ideas themselves have vanished with the dissolution of the human mind. The perfection of despotism, the permanent establishment of a hegemonic structure of power based on its ability to eliminate the very ideas of freedom, rights, democracy, and equality. So too, when we are trying to conceive how we might improve this situation some for those who live here now, and even more importantly for those who will come after us. Everything we talk about is based upon the fact that we have control over our technology, that we make our law, and that we struggle together for the politics that rules us. From here until the end, then, or at least from here until what some will call the end and I will call the middle, the space between courses, the moment at which we move from thinking about society as civil construction, economic and social, which we have been doing in this term, to a more politicized version in which we think about the state and its power and its effort to grow and maintain its power as the primary focus of the second part of the inquiry, next term in the other course. From here until whatever point it is at which this thing called law in the internet society gives way to the thing called computers, privacy, and the Constitution, by which time you may well have left the train, and we wish you a good and safe trip to your final destination. I need to talk then about what we can do in technology, in law, and in politics to preserve our values just a little longer, and thus to inhibit the dissolution of the nature of human mind. The technology, as I have pointed out, forms the anatomy and physiology of the nervous system we have made for the human race to share. I spent important time, at least time I needed to spend on something useful, talking about the intellectual property meltdown and free software. Well, of course, I mean, it's a law school. Everybody wants to know about intellectual property. And I needed to try and explain why that conception is both internally inconsistent and socially oppressive, to remind us that the goal of the network was that every brain on Earth should be able to learn whatever it wanted to learn, that all Einsteins would learn physics, that all Shakespeares would learn to read and write, that the human race would multiply its powers not merely by increasing the quality of the intelligence of the few, but the quantity of the intelligence of the many by allowing ignorance to perish, which was both the goal of free software, to make a network that would restore equality of power over how it worked to everybody who would otherwise be merely a user, and to do that in a way which modeled the availability of all powerful human knowledge to anyone who wants it. By hacking copyright law, we meant to bring about a network that would destroy ignorance forever, by making it possible for any brain anywhere to learn anything it wanted to learn, regardless of its poverty or wealth in the body in which it was born into society, and regardless of the power of any government to censor or control, to make thought free as the people of our party have been struggling for 1,000 years to make thought free in our social world. But in doing so, we also enabled the growth of the parasite. Free software gave to the institutions that collect behavior the software environment and the processes of the social construction of software that enabled them. We produced, without capital expenditure, the capital equipment of surveillance capitalism. At the same time, however, our original purpose continued to be. The technologies of freedom, as Ithiel de Solapool called them in the late 1970s, well, early 1980s, the technologies of freedom still exist. We made them first. The technologies of the parasitism were built on top of them. The platform companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters of this world need free software. They are made of it. They make it. They instantiated and then took over and operated the structures of shared software making. The distributed version control systems and the structures of project management and governance and the system of voluntary equality, which makes hackers working on their own from their high school labs and their suburban bedrooms into the equal of the largest of the technology corporations of the world in sharing together ways of making and the things they make. Benefiting from the immense spread of technical knowledge, because free software is the technical training system on which everybody can learn to do everything that computers can do just by reading things that are available to everybody freely and without restriction, based on principles of share and share alike. We let you do and know and study and improve everything we've ever made as long as you do the same with everyone who comes after you. All of that has made it possible for structures driven by profit to build the organs of the parasite and to assemble that organism and to give it power, electrical and data power, to put the bits in its maw that allow it to secrete the enzymes to get more bits, and that have built the phones or tablets or spy satellites in the pocket, on the table, in everybody's field of view all the time, buzzing and beeping and battering bodies with the knowledge that somebody wants you. Squirting little bits of dopamine and cholines, arousing and pacifying, all of that made out of what we made to make freedom, to put freedom in everything, to flip the switch and turn freedom on. That there was free software was in itself a difficult concept to get across, I know. People had a hard time believing that the world actually is made of things that people made to share. How could that be? An initial encounter with the repression of cognitive dissonance, and as you see from your own introspection and from watching your colleagues around you, this was in itself often an almost impossibly high hill to climb. But this, too, is part of the process by which we learn how to encounter what has changed. The net, from a physiological point of view, is made of services. The way our genetic and anatomical development is basically physiologically a bunch of proteins folding themselves around things and pushing molecules around and squeezing molecules together, using templates folded up out of things that can be built from a digital system that we call our DNA. All of the physiology of the network, then, as we have described it, is services. One computer contacting another computer and saying, here, this is a request, do something for me. Whether it's the service provided by the thing nearest your hand, hey, beep for me, buzz for me, get that fool's attention for me, show that fool a picture of some genitalia that will make her or him or it or them absolutely definitely, or a piece of violence or some thing they've always wanted at a price they can't believe is all they need to pay. Whatever it is, the service of conscripting the human attention, well, that's the one you're not usually thinking about. You're usually thinking about the service you think you're initiating. Give me that email message. Let me see that post. Let me see that photograph that somebody is sharing with me to know whether I like it or not. But of course, this is the Newtonian truth about services, that for every service, there's an equal and opposite service. Everything you think you're asking for is accompanied by things the parasite is asking for that you are doing, swiping, clicking, liking, not liking, etc., etc. So if the net is made of services, then the question is, what is the structure of the market in those services, where we use market in the broadest sense? As I said, we spent a bunch of time and some of our reading or listening to my tedious words on the subject, we spent a bunch of time understanding how a system originally created for the purpose of removing hierarchy and creating peerage as the center of how computers communicate with one another, and therefore how users of computers communicate with one another, the system that was meant for reducing inequality and eliminating hierarchy in order to achieve better military survivability became instead a system in which services were hierarchically organized. The technical trades are going through an effort to modify vocabulary now, because the metaphorical use in software engineering of phrases like master and slave or master and servant has come up against the reality that we embed in our language inequalities that we then use without consciousness to motivate and structure society. And so a bunch of language is being removed from comments all over computer programs throughout the world to remove the language of hierarchy and to leave behind the hierarchical realities that that language used to represent. So we are eliminating from technical reference manuals and the comments on programs the concepts of master and servant. But we are leaving behind technologies which were organized around those metaphors. And it was the purpose of Freedom in the Cloud to make a historical point about, as well as to propose, even a decade ago, before the worst of all this started, how to avoid it. Because, of course, the nature of the technology that is the net, the anatomy that supports this physiology, can support a different physiology in which services are not rendered hierarchically and in a centralized fashion. Google, by centralizing mail and the physiology of mail, sending it, receiving it, searching for it, filtering out the stuff you would never want to see, which is what we call spam, that is email you know you don't want, all those technological services surrounding mail, which is now the longest and most literarily sophisticated form of communication in which most human beings ever engage with one another, the services surrounding mail, once centralized, can be used to spy on all that mail, to read all its content, to analyze all the traffic in order to use human beings' communication with one another to craft better advertising with which to surround the mail in the browser window. But mail is an inherently federated service. That is to say, the APIs adopted by consensus, the rules with which we structure email messages, how headers are formatted, what headers are mandatory, what headers are optional, how to distinguish headers from headers in the top of the email message, how to move mail from one place. All of the rules surrounding mail assume that there can be as many mail servers as there are computers that move mail. And every human being may have as many mailboxes and use mail in as many different ways as there are human beings who wish to do it. And there can be as many mail tools as people want, and they can be both inside browsers and, God forbid, be sure, not inside browsers, and they can be web native and they can be not web native, and they can be secure and they can be insecure, and they can include all possible kinds of encryption and every possible kind of cloaking of identity or location. And all of that can be achieved because we can federate rather than centralize the way we use mail, much as we can either try to govern a society as a collection of communities, each with powers to rule itself, or we can attempt to turn everything into a pyramid with a vanguard on the flanks and a great leader on the top. And it's not just mail. The most important question in 2010, because the parasite was under construction and we were in danger of losing freedom in the cloud, the most important question of 2010 had to do with the form of social sharing that we now think of as Facebook. That is to say, web services for running a web server so other people can get files from you, so that you can share using the structures federated into the web, but in a centralized fashion in which somebody gets to watch everybody else read. These fools, says Zuckerberg in his Harvard days, they trust me. That means he operated a KGB venue, a bar where everybody got to meet and exchange and hit on one another, but it was an instrumented bar in which he got to watch everybody flirt. Ooh, how cool is that? And how capable of being turned to the benefit of the intelligence services of the world, and it's so convenient, and by not federating social sharing, we created the largest private intelligence services that have ever existed. Intelligence services so much vaster than the services of all the societies in the world but one or two, that they remodel what it means to spy. And all because those federated services of the web are replaced by the centralized services of the web server over here called Facebook and the microblogger over there called Twitter. And by centralizing those services and attaching them to behavior collection services, they achieved something beyond even their own wildest imaginations. They came together to create the entity that is the parasite, that is capable of changing the very nature of what it means to be a human being, to dissolve the practical conception of the human mind. It therefore follows that refederating services in the net, decentralizing these forms of sharing, giving people easy ways to produce these services for themselves. So I have a way that my family and my friends can share among one another that don't require that we interact for free with the behavior collecting form of the same service. I don't need Facebook, I don't need Twitter, I don't need WhatsApp, I don't need Zoom. I have a way of making these services for others. Others have a way of making these services for me. The network allows us to provide to one another what these other people will provide to us, quote, for free, at the cost of the collection of all our behavior. And by refederating these services, we can decrease rapidly and overwhelmingly the amount of behavior collected by the providers of services. Similarly, although we require the telecommunication services, we need the bit movers, they are essentially capable of being reduced back to wholesalers of communications opportunity. Sellers not of switching capacity now, because switching capacity exists everywhere and is so cheap that switching is not a saleable commodity, they produce packet movement. They run piping, they get signals from A to B, and by pervasively using encryption of our own, we can limit them to that. Over-the-top services, deep packet inspection, all the structures which advantage the telecommunications providers can be significantly, though not completely, reduced once we have adopted federative forms of encryption, opportunistic and permanent, and we begin to control secrecy for ourselves. Once we have established control of secrecy for ourselves, though we cannot establish permanent and perfect anonymity for ourselves, we can gain substantial control over our identity, where it is, where it isn't, where we are linked, where we aren't linked to things which are known about people who aren't necessarily us. And by regaining control of secrecy and some degree of control over anonymity, we are capable of preserving autonomy against influence based on invasion. So, simple technological changes, or at least changes which can be experienced by the people not involved in making the technology as simple, can do important work. They're not, by themselves, sufficient to eliminate the harms done by centralized behavior-collecting forms of simple federated services. To the extent that we can refederate those services, we need to become able to make and run server computers, that is, computers answering requests and providing substantially equivalent things like email and microblogging and short messaging and photo sharing, and to do those things in a form which allow human beings to operate as one another's partners, rather than as endpoints intermediated by some super partner in the center. And if we accomplish that in forms which increase the use of encryption among people, without the intervention of and without any control over what they are doing by parties in the middle, men in the middle doing harm, men in the middle making profits, persons in the middle controlling government, if we can simply federate the services and increase the degree of control over secrecy and anonymity by individual human beings, we can technically significantly affect and reverse some portion of the harm being done. Like carbon sequestration technology, like efforts to move the energy base of society from fossil fuels to renewables and to hydrogen-based solutions. When we adopt these technologies, we do not make the problem go away. We do not achieve perfection. Technology is not the only leg on the stool, but what can be achieved simply and cheaply and powerfully is a great contribution to the transformation of the problem. Federating services requires, as I say, that we move from vast data centers using cheap hydropower everywhere on the planet where cheap hydropower is under the control of capital-intensive organizations busy building systems of centralized services in which the bulk of the investment isn't in the provision of the services, which are cheap and trivial. It costs nothing to run an email server. The bulk of the investments are on the surveillance and the monetizing behavior side, right? The bulk of the electricity, the bulk of the carbon footprint, the bulk of all the cost is spent on the side where the other services are, the back services, the ones you're not supposed to notice. Well, the handkerchief of convenience is being waved before your eyes. But in a fashion noticed by my co-authors Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in 1867, the technology of bourgeois capitalism is constantly engaged in undermining itself, in creating the reality of the contradictions which make it possible ultimately for the system to be replaced by one of more equality, democracy, and justice. That is to say, our ability to produce immense amounts of computing power in extremely cheap physical hardware forms, and our ability to use that cheap, ever-present hardware that's available everywhere and that consumes almost no electricity and that generates almost no heat, and the ability to do that, to spread the anatomy of the net out thin and equal, and to create the physiology of that net on the basis of free software that everybody can make together and share, and that everybody can see and understand and change and remove spy code from, and all of that does allow us, in fact, to build the net we want extremely inexpensively by human voluntary activity right on top of all this net we do not want. This is why the real purpose of the Freedom in the Cloud talk 10 years ago was to inspire the movement in the direction of secure free software sharing, to replace Facebook by better code that did a better job of helping human beings to be safe while not requiring them to leave their friends and other social connections behind, that motivated the four founders of the Diaspora Project, whose interesting and amazing and tragic subsequent lives were detailed by my dear friend, the late Jim Dwyer, in his book, More Awesome Than Money, but also to create in the Freedom Box Project a form of infrastructure in which any human being who wants to can create a platform for herself that offers all the services she needs to herself and all her family and friends using hardware so inexpensive that it costs less than the charger for the smart-ass phone that tries to be the ring that rules them all. We can use the most inexpensive of profuse hardware available everywhere, the tiny single-board computers that fit in the palm of your hand, and all the free software we built to create the network of equality that ruins ignorance and that frees every brain to learn. And we can run such computers for one another, federating services safely and securely in ways which maintain both the secrecy and the anonymity of people to the maximum extent possible. And so we can at least create in the same world we live now, using the same net in which we live now, using software we already have and services we already know how to perform at prices we can drive down to make it possible for every single person to participate, we can make the alternative anatomy, physiology, and behavior of the net we meant to want, and retrofit it into the net we do not want that we have now, and which is slowly dissolving the very nature of our appreciation of freedom. But this is only one leg on the stool. We also need both legal and political changes. The nature of the legal changes is not the application of antitrust law to break up the companies. The assumption of the current interest in using competition law is that there's nothing wrong with the technical architecture, there's only something wrong with corporate form and finance flows. And that won't help. It isn't just me saying that it won't help, it's that everybody not presently engaged in trying to use competition law is beginning to understand why competition law won't work. Francis Fukuyama, the conservative Hegelian who predicted the end of history back at the end of the 20th century, when the end of the Soviet Union was for some reason supposed to end history, Francis Fukuyama and colleagues have a piece in Foreign Affairs, the current issue, which I have asked you to read on the radar, which offers a completely different analytical framework in which to come to the same conclusion. The competition law enforcement against the platforms cannot solve this problem, that the problem lies, Francis Fukuyama figured this out. I'm overwhelmed with admiration for him. He figured out what I was saying 10 years ago, that actually what we need to do is to refederate services, except he doesn't know how to use the phrase because he doesn't understand how services are made. But being a great Hegelian, he has moved his way from thesis to antithesis all the way to synthesis, and he's only a half a generation late. What will not work is the assumption that this is essentially a problem of how many corporations or how they are financed or how they are allowed to behave on behalf of their shareholders. The competition law approach to the legal regulation that will solve this problem is conceptually wrong, because it does not put behavior collection at the center of what is happening, but it is structurally wrong because it assumes that the technical architectures that exist are fine, provided that something is done to the shareholder agreements or the covenants with lenders or the environment of mergers and acquisitions. It's just, right? It's the cart not just before the horse, but a mile past the horse, sitting by the side of the road, waiting to find out if the horse will ever show up. One thing that we need is comprehensive understanding of behavior regulation as the socioeconomic process at the center of the problem. The parasite collects behavior. It stimulates the production of more behavior. It prioritizes engagement over deliberation or freedom of thought. It therefore creates distortions in politics, and it threatens rule of law. Now, the aftermath of the presidential election in the United States this year has indicated that, as all the distortions and misinformation problems of the period from 2016 to 2020 demonstrated it. But we can't just say the government's going to regulate behavior collection. any more than we can say the government is going to fix the climate by regulating the emission of fossil fuel exhausts. It's true that that will have to happen, but it must happen in a context. The legal structures, like the technological structures, have to be reconsidered. We need not a system of how to enforce existing statutes, nor even a system of how to prop up existing captured agencies and uncapture them from the portions of the socioeconomic structure, Shoshana Zuboff christened surveillance capitalism, in order to provide more public-centered regulation. We need an architectural change. This, it turns out, is another part of the reason why the climate crisis and the privacy crisis are so deeply interrelated. Not only because they provide a shared opportunity for human beings to learn about that class of existential problems that happen too fast to ignore and too slow to see, but because the models by which, in the late 20th century, before the repression of cognitive dissonance kicked in as strongly as it has on behalf of the fossil fuel interests and their financiers, when we made environmental law in America for the first time and around the world other societies began also to make environmental law, what we learned from that process about how to make law is now the question that we can benefit from by thinking about how to make privacy law as though it were environmental law. We laid some of the groundwork of this process by learning to think about privacy questions not as matters of individual consent, but as matters of environmental harm, in which each of our individual actions has consequences that are both visible and yet remote on others, in which the creation of externalities, to use law school's favorite Coasean vocabulary, in which the creation of externalities is wide, and the weight, the burden of those externalities on other social processes is high, and we cannot really use bilateral models of consent to understand the nature of harm or the nature of regulation. We cannot say it's up to you and your family to contract for how the dirty or clean the water is you drink. It's not for you and your family to strike a bargain with the oil companies about how dirty the air will be in your backyard, because the drinking water and the air are common resources, and we cannot treat the common resources as subject to the individual binary decisions of bilateral contracting, yes or no, I will take those terms, I will refuse those terms. We need rather structures which accept that in the presence of these broad and complex external burdens that each of our own individual acts imposes, not just on ourselves, our relatives, our families, our friends, but the world as a whole, the community around us, the atmosphere in which we breathe, and the water that we all drink, that in order to do that, we need both systems for policy making and systems for specific rulemaking to govern dangers that are created by our common action. And so structures of environmental law were created around those designs, forcing policy questions to be internalized by individual projects and actions of government and private industry, and structures of science and politics and law organized within agencies operating under general charters to set social standards on behalf of all and to find efficient, financially viable mechanisms for seeing that those standards are observed across a spectrum of responses from subsidies and assistances in avoiding difficulties and cleaning up accidents to systems of criminal prosecution for deliberate efforts to destroy the benefit of the rules that help many on behalf of a few bad actors. Everything in between those endpoints structured to operate within judicially reviewable systems of rulemaking and prosecutorial and regulatory activity. We built such a system of environmental regulation, and any hope we have of controlling the runaway externalities modifying the biosphere of the planet depend upon our ability to use those systems that we built for this very purpose half a century ago. They also formulate a plan upon which such legal regulation on behalf of privacy and the autonomy of the human mind and preservation of human values can be built in the same way that we built the systems for considering policy and regulating activity on behalf of the quality of the external environment of the human race. And there, with the necessary legal architecture, we begin next time. Talk to you soon.